So, I said it's been about 5 years since we looked at this book together as a community. And it's not a coincidence that it's been that long, because the book of Revelation, it's scary to people. And I understand that. There's a lot of numbers and mythologies and animals and symbols and people standing up and singing and people bowing down and singing. Jesus coming, and you got all these images of him with bronze feet and white hair and eyes like fire. And people throughout the history of the church have read this book of Revelation, or rather, appropriately, probably misread it, as a way to say that this is going to indicate when the end times are coming. As sort of a, as if we could use it as a calendar, saying, okay, now it's going to happen because these things are falling in line. To do that would be to oversimplify this book and the beauty that it brings. Because remember, even Jesus at the time in the book of Mark, he says, not even the Son, not even he knows when it's coming back. I might blow your mind a little bit. I'll unpack that for you if you want. You can ask me after service. But even Jesus, almost the book of Revelation isn't meant for that necessarily. What it's meant to do is to guide the church and the people in the church through hardships, through sufferings. John, as he's writing to these seven churches, what we'll see over the remaining weeks is that the church now is in peril of being oppressed. Some people are being impaled onto sticks, lit onto fire, lining the city, the road, in and out of Rome. And John's writing this book, rather Jesus is speaking these letters, these words, to give hope when there is no hope. To give a glimmer of light in the midst of suffering. And this is why, and I've said this many times, if you've ever heard me talk about the word Revelation, this is why, more than anything, I call it a love letter. You may not think that at first. I know that if you've heard the book of Revelation or if you read it, you don't necessarily think of it as a love letter at first, but actually it is, and we'll see this in the church in Ephesus, in chapter 2, next week. Jesus says, "You forgot me. Your first love, me," he says. See, any love letter, any good love letter, if you've been given love letters, hopefully you have, they're really nice. Hopefully somebody's written you a love letter, and you know when they write you a love letter. It's not to condemn you. It's not to judge you. It's not to put you down. It's to lift you up. It's to give you hope. It's to give you an inner narrative of the beauty that's inside your heart that somebody else can see, but you may not be able to see it right. This is what Jesus is doing. He's looking at each of his churches, these seven churches, and he's saying, "Here's my love letter. Come back." It's extremely instructive for us as a church to look at this book. And let me say this too. Let me add on to this. This genre of literature, I gotta talk about genre of literature just for a second. Bear with me. Because the book of Revelation is tricky, like I said, it's scary and it's tricky to some people because we don't have this type of genre of literature much anymore. It's called apocalyptic literature. Apocalyptic, that doesn't sound scary. Ooh, a big word. Oh, fire, hail. No, it doesn't mean that. Apocalyptic literature, say that five times fast, was literature given to people to explain to them that there was hope, that one day good will prevail, that the darkness will go away and the sun will shine. And that's what these people needed. They need it, and you and I need it. And Jesus is going to give us what it means to be the church, but first and foremost, tonight what we're looking at, before we get into the letters about the churches, before we get into how to be the church and what the church should do and shouldn't do, you got to know, he's back. He's back. You may not think it makes that much of a difference for you. But when you start to meditate on the fact that Jesus is back in the way that he is and of how he presents himself to John, it will and it should utterly shape and change everything in your life. It does to John. John was the apostle. John knew Jesus. John was his right-hand man almost. But John says, "When I see him now, I fall down as if dead." It's pretty salty stuff. let's fall down to him. Not dead, as if dead. And see what it means that Jesus is back. And I put it this way, your outline, you can follow him. What does it mean to be a community of Christ, centered on him? This is part of our vision statement here at Soul Grace Community, that we're centered on the gospel. What does it mean? Here's what it means. First, you got to see three things here. And I put it in prepositions, so for those of you who are fans of the English language, you can follow along. Jesus with the clouds, the apostle on the ground, and the lampstands in the fire. Get it? With, on, in. Here. First, Jesus with the clouds. In verse 7, it says that he's come back. And he's coming with the clouds. Hold on to that. I'll unpack that in a second, because it's vitally important for you and me to know that. But Jesus is coming back, and he's coming back to judge. Now what this is doing, if you look back at the books of Daniel, actually the book of Revelation is so steeped in the Old Testament, you gotta read your Old Testament to follow what's going on in Revelation. This prophecy of Jesus coming back in the clouds, with the clouds, it's a fulfillment of Daniel 7, Zechariah 12. Daniel 7, it says that he's coming back and he'll appear and he's going to smite them. And then in Zechariah 12, it says that they're going to mourn, and that Hebrew word is actually repent. What it means is this: Jesus is coming back to undo everything. All the sadness, all the hurt, all the pain, all the loss, all the tragedy. He's coming back with the clouds. We call this in theological terms, it's a fancy term, the doctrine. Do you know what I need that word doctrine? What's the doctrine of the second coming? The doctrine of the second coming, and I know I sat where you sat for many years, and a pastor said, let's learn about the doctrine of the second coming tonight. I go, okay. What is a matter of second? Oh, okay, no. But it's vitally important. You must know this. Because you can't live without it. If Jesus is coming back to judge, it means you and I don't have to judge. If he's coming back with the clouds, it means you and I don't have to come on the clouds and rain onto everybody else. You see? The human heart has the propensity not only to judge others, but to judge ourselves. Aren't we good at that? I joked last week, I said, you know, if somebody else lies, you say they're a dirty liar. But if you lie, it's complicated, right? If somebody else does something wrong, you say, oh, they're horrible people. But if you do something wrong, there's layers. It's complex. You won't understand. See, it's incredibly easy for us to judge others. But the doctrine of the second coming means we don't have to. We're off the throne of judgment for others and for ourselves. It's incredibly liberating. It's incredibly freeing. And it gives you an incredible eternal perspective. You look at others and you say, I can't judge them. That's his job. He's coming with the clouds. I don't need to. You say it for others, and you also say it for your own heart. I don't need to condemn myself. He's coming with the clouds. Jesus coming back removes you and me from the throne of judgment, which, if we're honest, can we be honest tonight? We're in church. Let's be honest. We love sitting on that throne of judgment, don't we? Don't you love looking at other people and pointing out all their flaws? But then somebody points out your flaws and you say, well, you don't understand. It's complex. There's levels. They made me do it. I was put in a situation. The second coming, the doctrine of the second coming, means that judgment is his, not yours. Judgment is his, not mine. You know how liberating that is? You don't judge others, you don't judge yourself. You're free. You have an eternal perspective now. And you'll need it every day when you go to work. You'll need to see in the light of eternity. Every day as you go to class, you'll need to see in the light of eternity. You and I need that. We need him with the clouds. Because if he's not coming in judgment, then you will, and I will. What this does, this doctrine of the second coming, it makes you start to say, what if he does come with the clouds tomorrow? You see what eternal perspective gives you? John was writing to people who are suffering, being impaled, lit on fire, tortured. And he says, look, he's coming with the glory and the clouds. Find peace in them, find rest in them. Here's what it does. Let me apply it very practically for you. the doctrine of the second coming business, if you start to apply it in your life, what you start to do is you start to see everything, everything in the light of eternity. Every song you sing, you'll start to say, what am I singing that in heaven when he comes with the clouds? Every time you talk to one other person, you'll say, what am I talking to this person when he comes with the clouds? It gives you a liberating, eternal perspective. And it starts to make you put the world in perspective. C.S. Lewis puts it this way. There's a the famous John Donne poem. It says, what if this present were the world's last night? It's his poem. I don't want to read you the poem. I'll read his quote. C.S. Lewis did an essay on this. What if this present were the world's last night? Let me put it this way. What if you knew he's coming with the clouds? How would it change your behavior, your language, your perspective on things? C.S. Lewis puts it this way. Any moralist will tell you that the personal triumph of an athlete or a girl at a ball is transitory. The point is to remember that an empire or a civilization is also transitory. All achievements, triumphs, insofar as they merely are this worldly achievements and triumphs, will come to nothing in the end. He says, most scientists here join hands with the theologians. The heart will not, the earth will not always be habitable. Man, though longer lives than men, is equally mortal. The difference is that whereas the scientists expect only a slow decay from within, we reckon with sudden eruption from without at any moment. And he ends by saying, what if this present were the world's last night? What if this present were the world's last night? Do you see, when Jesus is coming on the clouds, you know what it means for you? Expect it. Start to meditate on it. And it'll give you a perspective on your job, on your work, on your classmates, on your friendships, on your marriage, on your kids. You start to see everything in the light of eternity. Oh, and that light is beautiful. C.S. Lewis, I put another quote in there. What he says is this, I'll explain it this way. He says it's as if, when you're putting on clothes in the department store. And he says people make a mistake. They put on clothes in the department store and they pretend, or they imagine that it's going to look the same in the department stores when they get outside. And he says the department store is a pale light compared to the eternal light outside, the sun, when it shines. You'll see yourself the way you always were meant to be when he comes with the clouds. Judgment, it's not yours, it's not mine. We're free. It's precisely because we cannot predict the moment, we must be ready at all times. We must train ourselves to ask more and more often how the thing we are saying or doing or failing to do at each moment will look when the irresistible light streams in upon it. That irresistible light that is so different from the light of this world. That will reveal all things that they truly are. It says women, by the way, this goes for men too. We plan on closing the department store too. C.S. Lewis just said, women, but you can include men, sometimes have the problem of judging by artificial electric lights. How their clothing and makeup will look by the full light of the sun. This is what we have to do. We have to learn how to dress our souls, not for the electric lights of the present world, but for the daylight of the next one. The good dress, the one that will face that light, for that light will last forever. Let me ask you this, before I move on to the next point. Do you dress yourself in the light, the irresistible light, that won't fade? Aren't you tired of dressing yourself in the department store pale lights? When Jesus comes with the clouds, he comes with light and judgment. And he says, here's eternity. It's for you. Stop wasting your time in the pale light. Step into the irresistible light. And as I said, I don't have time to unpack this. Jesus coming with the clouds. Remember, look at the preposition here. In the Greek, you have it. Look at this. He doesn't say on the clouds. He doesn't say through the clouds. And he doesn't say next to the clouds. He says with it. And almost every commentator that I can find points out this. This is Jesus coming with the cloud of glory. God's glory. If you're familiar with the Old Testament, you know what this cloud is. It's his wing. It's his presence. And Jesus says, I come with it. Stop trying to come with your clouds to others. Jesus says, I bring the weight. I bring your significance. I'm the one who's going to put light on you. I'm the only one that matters, he says. Next, the apostle on the ground. You got to see Jesus coming with the clouds. You gotta know judgment is. You gotta see eternity tonight. And I know that's a big thing, and I know it's like 5 o'clock and you're thinking maybe, oh, I gotta worry about dinner and things like that, and I know you're now pastor's saying I gotta think about my dinner in light of eternity, and that's a lot of weight on you. I know. What are you gonna have for dinner? Think about it. It could be your last meal, you're coming with the clouds. But I am purposely pushing home this point tonight. Because I know it's so easy to be lost in the mundane of everyday struggles and trials. It's so easy to be lost in the mundane of people not giving you the respect that you feel you deserve. And it's so easy to be caught in the mundane of changing diapers day in and day out. If you have a baby, if you don't, you'll see it. It gets boring after a while. And now, with Jesus coming with the clouds, next time you change a diaper, you can say, I'm doing this in light of eternity. Isn't that weird? Isn't that sound weird? But Jesus says, I'm coming with the clouds. I'm back, baby. And it makes all the difference for the way you and I live all our lives and the way you and I live towards another. Now, the apostle on the ground. Why is this significant? John, who knew Jesus, Jesus shows up. And John falls. It's sensory overload. In verse 16, it says, it's like the sun shining in full strength. I tell you this, common sense. Stare at the sun. You'll never see things the same again. Go stare at it. Don't stare at it. It's a joke. Don't do it. But if you were to stare at it, if you were to gaze at the sun, you would never see things the same again. This is John. Jesus is his homie, his friend, his close confidant. He knew Jesus, and now this Jesus makes him fall down to the ground as if dead. It's awesome, it's powerful, it's wonderful, and you and I believe it. See, go back in time a little bit. In the book of Genesis, we're told that you and I were made in his image. That Adam and Eve walked with him and talked with him. They were made for the very face of God. In Genesis, get to Exodus, and Moses says, I want to see your face, and God says, you can't, because you'll die. And in Isaiah says, whoa, it's me. I can't even be in his presence. What's happened? Sin, brokenness, pain, loss, us, we've happened. We became a hot mess. At one point, we were made for his face. And at one point, we couldn't stand his face. Now he's back. And we get his face. By all rights, John, supernaturally speaking, should be dead. But he's not. He falls as if dead. And there's this really cool part, if you go back in the passage. It says that Jesus places his right hand on him. You know what that means? It wasn't like he was just touching him. Like, I can touch you with my right hand, it won't mean much. But you know what it means here? The right hand is the hand of glory and honor and significance. How powerful of an image is this? John says, I hear something. I'm turning around. My old friend doesn't look the same as he did before. I fall down. And Jesus says, here's my hand. You're significant. Though you should be dead, and you and I, by rights, in the presence of Jesus, should be dead. John should die. That's what the Bible says. We're made for his face. Now we don't deserve his face, but Jesus comes back and he says, you get my face again. And when you start to sink your teeth into that, imagine this when you go to sleep tonight. Whatever you're going through in life right now, whatever pains you have, whatever trials you've been going through, imagine Jesus, your Lord and your Maker, taking his right hand, the one of honor, the one fit for kings, the one fit for royalty, and he puts it on you. That's awesome. That's pretty cool stuff. Jesus says, I come with the clouds. It's my glory, not yours. Stop trying to find your own sense of glory. Rest in me. I'm with the clouds, Jesus says. And he comes down and he's so powerful and all these images of eyes with fire and he's like looking in the sun. And by all rights, John shouldn't be alive. And Jesus says, here's my hand. It's a hand of mercy and it's a hand of grace. It's your hand. It's his put on you. And forgiveness. See him with the clouds. See the apostle on the ground. But lastly, here's the most important part. This whole funny business of the lampstands. What is that? Anybody know? You can answer. We're a small church. Lampstands. What does it say? What is that supposed to mean? Lampstands and stars. And you start, okay, now I'm getting into numbers and seven. The lampstands of the church, and what you must see is where Jesus stands in this passage. He says the lampstands of the church, you, by the way, because you're here. And if this is your first time here at Soul Grace, it doesn't really matter. You're here, and by the merits of you being here, you're a lampstand this evening. And this passage of Revelation says something absolutely profound. It says that Jesus stands where? Trigger quotes here. Look at your passage. Does he stand behind the lampstands? Does he stand next to them? Does he like dance around them? He's right in the middle. He's right in the middle. John, his readers would have surely known the weight and the significance of what that meant. Remember, let me explain something, what's going on at the time. I gave a little hint before. If you called yourself a Christian at this time, you're in for it. They were put on sticks. They had hot metal poured into their ear to kill them. They were lit on fire. They would line streets. You know how sick this is? So that visitors to and from Rome could see them coming in and out from the road. And in all of this, John, Jesus, has the audacity to say, I'm right in the middle of all your suffering and of all your pain. I'm not over there. I'm not back there. I'm right here. Extreme persecution. Let me push this a little further for you. If you go back to the book of Daniel, commentators point out that the imagery here, when he says, one like a son of man, is remarkably similar to Daniel, the book of Daniel, chapter 3, verse 25. Go back to it. Maybe you've heard this story. Our Daniel's good friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You remember these guys? What happened to them? The emperor said, bow, worship me. They said no. He ripped them up, tied them up, threw them in the fire. It was so hot, that fire, that even the people who threw the guys in there burned up and died. And there's a little time there, and Nebuchadnezzar says, well, what's happening? I don't hear anything. So he looks in the fire, and the three guys are walking around, unhurt. That would be cool. Maybe you believe it, maybe you don't. But it's a cool story, right? Three dudes in the fire, not burned. But there's something way cooler. Because the emperor looks in the fire, and he says, wait a second. Didn't I put three guys in there? Now there's a fourth. And he looks like a son of the gods. Brothers and sisters, tonight, don't let this imagery miss your heart. Jesus says, you're the church, you're the lampstands, and I'm in the middle of it. Every other friend will sit by you while you suffer. And they may be a good friend, and they may cry with you, and they may hold you. And they may say, this sucks for you, and I'm sorry for this. This is the only one who goes into the furnace with you. John sees his feet like bronze that look like they were from the furnace. Why? Because he went to the furnace for you. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, three went in, four were there. As a way of God saying, whatever furnace you go into, I'm there. And the cross is proof of it. No other God will say this to you. No other worldview will tell you this. Everybody else will say, your suffering's horrible, and I'm sorry for it. And I'll try to help you through it. This is the key news. Your suffering's horrible, and I know it because I took it. I went to the furnace for you so that you know that in whatever furnace you go through, I've already
for you?
What can't you survive as a community, as a church, as a lampstand? This should entirely change the way that you and I view suffering. I don't have a good answer for it, but I've been asked for the last 5.5 years that I've been a pastor many times. Pastor, which is a good question. Why is there suffering? I don't know. Isn't that nice? It'd be great if I could give you a wonderful answer to summarize why suffering exists in the world. I don't know. I don't know why you and I have to cry. You and I have to feel pain and hurt. And you and I have to be dejected by people. And you and I have to be cursed, lied about, and mistreated. I don't know why. But Jesus, in the lampstands, shows me that he went to the furnace. And he's there with you all the time. This is why Paul, in the book of 2 Corinthians, when he's writing to the church, this is why he's able to say, his grace is sufficient, because his power is made perfect in weakness. Do you see? Jesus is the only God. He's the only friend. He's the only king. He's the only lover. He's the only one. He says, I burn as you burn. But nothing will burn you like it did me. Because I went to the cross, I went to hell for you. Now I'm coming with the clouds. And that should make all the difference for you and for me. That's the gospel. That's all it is. It's the good news. That no matter what furnace you feel tossed into your life, and if you're not in one now, just wait, it'll come. You know that you have the only Lord and Savior who went to the ultimate furnace for you. Now, see him with the clouds. Now, fall down and feel his right hand forevermore. Blessing you. As I close, you know what this means furthermore, the way the lampstand? It means that you and I should be the ones who take this truth and light up the darkness. You and I should be the ones who are so shaken to the core by the love that Jesus would give to give his own life for us that we become a lampstand and we light up the darkness around us. This world is broken. It's messed up. It's fouled up. And there's lots of problems. And Jesus says, you have the church on the lampstand. And over the next 7 weeks, we'll see what that means practically play out. For now, see him in the furnace of death for you. See him in glory. Fall down. Feel his right hand. And know that he comes with the clouds. It will start to shape everything differently in your life. This is the irresistible light. Not the pale dim lights even of this world. This is the sun that you and I have always wanted. The sunshine on us to warm us. The light that shows you who you really are. Beautiful. Saved. Forgiven. Cherished. Rescued from the furnace. Go in prayer now. Meditate on this truth. Reflect on it. Spend the next 4 minutes taking it in.